headlines, Italy's Prime Minister-designate Draghi wraps up his first round of talks for forming a new government as the country's grappling with economic and COVID-19 crises. A senior member of Iraq's al-Nujub movement says resistance groups are determined to end U.S. military presence in their country. And thousands of people gather in Tunisia to protest against that country's political crisis and economic woes. And welcome from Tehran. You've tuned into the World News. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Appreciate you being with us. Well, the first story this hour takes us to Italy, where the quest for a new government continues as Prime Minister-designate Mario Draghi finishes the first round of talks with parties in Parliament. Draghi has so far gathered support from a number of parties, but not enough to secure a majority. On the third and final day of the first stage of talks, the former European Central Bank chief negotiated with the two largest groups in Parliament. Mattia Salvini's right-wing League party says it has not yet decided to back Draghi, but declared that common ground has been found. The anti-establishment five-star movement, Italy's biggest party, says it will put its weight behind him only if his policies are in line with those of the party.
We said we were open to considering whether the conditions are right to join the government, and we will check our availability again when we discuss further to understand the framework. Starting first of all, and I repeat, from the key themes.
Draghi cannot have both of Italy's top parties in his potential ruling coalition, as the League has said it will not join a government with the M5S. On Wednesday, President Sergio Mattarella tasked the former EU official with forming a government. That nearly a month after the ruling coalition collapsed following Italia Viva party's withdrawal from the outgoing Prime Minister Conte's ruling coalition. They accused Conte of mishandling the coronavirus and the subsequent economic meltdown. The coronavirus pandemic surges across Europe, with several countries reporting more deaths and infections. In the Netherlands, the number of infections surpassed a grim milestone of 1 million after health authorities reported over 4,000 daily new cases. More than 14,300 people have also died from the disease. In Russia, 16,600 new cases were reported, together with nearly 500 new fatalities. The infections now stand at nearly 4 million and the deaths at 76,000. In Germany, some 10,500 new infections were registered and nearly 700 new deaths. Well, COVID-19 clusters on U.S. military bases in South Korea are raising alarm with the country's public and as well as activists. Many are worried about the virus being spread from U.S. service members to the general South Korean population. Frank Smith brings us more from South Korea.
U.S. military personnel deploying from the American mainland to bases abroad are bringing COVID-19 with them. In South Korea, more than 700 United States Forces Korea members have tested positive for the virus, raising alarms in South Korea.
Since Americans value individual freedom and personal liberty, they have tendencies to not adhere to South Korean quarantine guidelines. Therefore, in the case of Pyeongtaek, living with the U.S. military, there is a high risk of exposure to coronavirus.
U.S. Forces Korea soldiers have repeatedly flouted local COVID-19 precautions, including holding a large maskless party. In January, U.S. bases here issued shelter-in-place orders because of COVID-19 cluster outbreaks.
The U.S. Forces Korea Camp Humphreys said in a February 1st press release that less than 1% of its active duty troops had tested positive for COVID-19. If we compare that to how South Korea is dealing with the virus, it's 10 times more likely for a U.S. soldier on a military base here to have COVID-19 than someone in the general South Korean population.
U.S. forces here have begun administering the vaccine, although new cases continue to arrive on almost a daily basis.
It seems that it is necessary to thoroughly manage corona-confirmed patients through testing before entering Korea. And more thorough management measures should be implemented, not only for the U.S. military, but also for South Korean employees on the U.S. base who have a lot of contact with people.
Meanwhile, South Korea continues to experience hundreds of new cases each day, with the rollout of a vaccine set to begin here this month. Frank Smith, Pyeongtaek, South Korea.
Now it's time for this hour's news review. A senior member of Iraq's al-Nujab movement says resistance groups are determined to end the U.S. military presence in their country.
The Iraqi resistance, namely the popular mobilization forces, are the ones that made Daesh flee, of course in cooperation with others, but it had the biggest role. The resistance kicked out the first American occupation before Daesh. It's now leading calls for confronting the new American occupation that Washington wants to resume in Iraq.
Shamiri made the comments in an interview with Press TV. Well, the Nujba movement is part of Iraq's popular mobilization units, or the PMU, that fought against the Daesh terrorist group. Calls have been growing for the expulsion of foreign troops from Iraq since the U.S. targeted killing of Iran's top general, Qasem Soleimani, and Iraqi commander Abu Mahdi al-Mohandas. The two anti-terror icons were assassinated in a drone strike near Baghdad's airport in January of 2020. Days later, Iraqi lawmakers passed a bill requiring the government to call Washington to withdraw American troops from the country. I'd like to welcome my guests to this news review out of Ontario, Robert Fantina, author and activist, and out of Beirut, Laith Maruf, activist and political commentator. Thank you both for being with us. Let's starting it off with Robert. Well, Robert, once again, the PMU is calling for the U.S. Military to leave the country. How likely is that going to happen now under a Biden administration, your perspective?
It's not very likely to happen at all. The United States plays lip service to supporting self-determination of all nations around the world. If it did so, it would leave Iraq because the government of Iraq has asked it to do so. But that isn't what is of interest to the United States. They're interested in oil, they're interested in power, and so the Biden administration will be very hesitant to withdraw from Iraq. It will give all kinds of excuses about security and helping the people, but the people have said they do not want the U.S. soldiers there and they don't want American presence. The United States always feels it knows what's best for any country and will force that upon that country. So I don't foresee Biden withdrawing troops from Iraq, which he should definitely do.
Laith, your take, and if what our guest in Kitchener said, that the U.S. will not withdraw troops, but on the other hand, we hear members of the PMU saying they must, the American troops must leave Iraq. What exactly does that mean from a security perspective inside of Iraq, in your perspective?
Well, we should be expecting an increase in resistance attacks on American troops. We could also presume that there will be a return to more American operations under the guise of CIA, not military, meaning there may be no increase in American numbers of troops in Iraq, but there will be a return to the use of intelligence assets like Al-Qaeda and ISIS, the Wahhabi Contras that are under control of Saudi Arabia and the United States. And we saw that at the time of Obama, Biden, the first 4 years ago before Trump, that was the main activities of the United States is using those assets there. If we remember also at the end of the Obama term before Trump took over, there was a mutiny from the American army against Kerry and Biden when they attempted to withdraw the troops from Syria. And the Americans attacked the Syrian troops in their Zorda, the American soldiers. So we have probably a shift back into the CIA leading the American activities in Syria and Iraq.
Robert, what will it take in your perspective then? On the one hand, we have Iraqi people themselves wanting these troops to leave. On the other hand, both of you are saying that's not likely to happen under a Biden administration. So what has to happen here in order for the Iraqi people to reach their goal of not having foreign occupation by American military there?
It's very challenging because the U.S. government feels it's a law unto itself. It needn't adhere to international law or the desires of the countries in which it is interfering. An increase in insurgency activity, which your other commentator said is likely to happen, but that will only stimulate more U.S. troops in Iraq because the U.S. government will say, look, see how insecure the security situation is there. We need to protect them. For this to end, the international community must act. The United Nations must further condemn U.S. interference in Iraq, and also the U.S. citizenry must work with their elected officials to demand that this interference cease. I don't see that happening anytime soon either, because there are so many other pressing issues in the United States: income inequality, the Black Lives Matter movement, which is an excellent and growing movement. But there's so many things that are impacting U.S. citizens directly that it's difficult for them to take a broader international view. But that is one of the things that will be required for the U.S. to finally leave Iraq.
And Leith, do you see this happening in the short term, or will this be a lengthy process with the Iraqis being able to get the American military to leave their country?
Well, I believe in the resistance, and if we see any occupation in history, didn't end with the goodwill of citizens of the occupying power, but it ended with hundreds of and thousands of body bags returning to that occupying country and the citizens crying on those body bags and pushing their government to leave. So the defining thing that will make a difference for shortening the time of American occupation of Iraq is an increase in the number of liquidated American occupying soldiers. And that's what's going to make a difference. And we should be expecting that a ratcheted up resistance is going to happen not only in Iraq, but in Syria too.
And on that note, thank both of you for being with us on this news review. Robert Fantina, author and activist out of Kitchener, Ontario. Leith Maruf, activist and political commentator out of Beirut. Thank you for staying with us for this news review. Continue with our news now, turning to Tunisia, where thousands of people have taken to the streets of the capital to vent their anger over the political and social situation in the country. Protesters held banners and chanted slogans calling for the fall of the government as they marched through the streets of Tunis. Riot police blocked some main avenues. Now, this is the latest in a series of nationwide protests that began in mid-January. Some rallies turned violent as police arrested thousands of people. Demonstrations are triggered by frustration over the country's political system and economic inequality. The recent cabinet reshuffle has caused a political logjam. Now, this is while the government is struggling to combat the coronavirus pandemic and its economic fallout. London-based political analyst Sami Hamdi says democratic transition has not translated into tangible economic development since the dictatorship was overthrown in 2011.
I think that while the democratic system has been established in Tunisia, while the dictatorship was overthrown in 2011 as a result of the people's protest, despite the fact that there were elections and parties took to parliament, the reality is that the democratic transition has not translated into tangible economic development or indeed responded to the original demands of the revolution, which were not entirely for democracy, even if perhaps that was an implied demand, but more to do with tackling unemployment and ending poverty and ending hunger. These were the three main issues. So in other words, the governments that have come about as a result of the democratic elections have not tackled any of these three issues. Unemployment is continuing to increase. There are larger numbers of Tunisians falling below the poverty line, and hunger is still rife, which is one of the reasons why, if you see some of the slogans in the protests, it's "I am hungry." Those are some of the banners that they are raising. And this is primarily because while Tunisia's democratic transition was celebrated, it was celebrated with the mindset that democracy was an ends and not a means. Democracy is supposed to bring about justice and supposed to bring about equitable social development. In Tunisia's case, it's failed to bring that about.
Moving on to other news this hour, the Israeli Prime Minister has rejected an international criminal court's ruling to investigate Tel Aviv's war crimes in the occupied Palestinian territories. Benjamin Netanyahu described the ICC's ruling as a prevention of justice. He stressed that Israel will fight against the ruling with all its might. Netanyahu has called the verdict pure anti-Semitism. On Friday, the ICC ruled that it has jurisdiction to investigate the atrocities in territories occupied by Israel since 1967, namely Gaza and the West Bank, including East Jerusalem.
The International Criminal Court has ruled that it has jurisdiction to examine possible Israeli war crimes in the occupied Palestinian territories. In a statement, the court announced that it has decided by majority that its territorial jurisdiction in the situation in Palestine extends to the territories occupied by Israel in 1967, namely the Gaza Strip and the West Bank, including East Jerusalem al-Quds. The ICC's decision has been praised by Palestinians, with Prime Minister Mohammad Shataya calling it a victory for justice.
The resolution is a message to the perpetrators of crimes that their crimes will not be subject to statutes of limitations and that they will not go unpunished.
The Palestinian Foreign Ministry also called the ruling a historic day for the principle of accountability, and the Palestinian resistance movement Hamas urged the court to investigate the Israeli crimes, describing its decision as a major development. Different international human rights organizations have also reacted, with Amnesty International calling the decision a long overdue step towards justice for victims. Human Rights Watch also described the ruling as a real hope for victims of serious crimes. Israel, which is not even a member of the ICC, decried the ruling, saying the court is a political body, not a judicial institution. As expected, the U.S. officially opposed the court's decision. Experts say the ruling is a game-changer for Tel Aviv and Washington.
Israeli objections to an investigation have no basis. The court has overruled basically Israel's objections to an investigation, which is long overdue at any rate. As far as Washington, President Biden will face an interesting challenge. I expect that his reaction will be considerably different than Trump's.
The ruling came amid Palestine's call for further scrutiny into the 2014 Israeli war on the Gaza Strip, in which more than 2,000 Palestinians, including hundreds of children, were killed. 6 years ago, the office of the court's chief prosecutor, Fatou Bensouda, began a preliminary investigation of Israeli actions in Gaza. In 2019, Bensouda announced that there was a reasonable basis for opening an investigation into the Gaza war and the regime's settlement activities in the occupied West Bank. Ironically, Israel has continued its crimes against the Palestinians and its expansionist agenda, including illegal settlement activities with the tacit support of the United States and in defiance of UN resolutions. International rights groups have long raised the alarm about Israeli atrocities. Last year, the UN also said that Tel Aviv's excessive force against Palestinians holding weekly anti-occupation rallies may amount to war crimes. The latest ICC ruling has dealt a severe blow to Israel, but will the Palestinians get the justice for crimes they have endured for decades remains to be open.
And with that, that brings us to the end of this World News Edition. Thanks so much for staying tuned.
Epic, glory, honor. This is Bahman, the month which reminds us of love and empathy. See the world through IRIB English Radio, the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Women, pioneers of the Islamic Revolution. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Dear listeners, today is the seventh day of the 10-day dawn, which marks the period in which the Islamic revolution of the Iranian people triumphed over the oppressive Pahlavi regime and put an end to 2,500 years of tyranny and oppression for good. The Islamic revolution was undoubtedly the most important event in the contemporary world and the 20th century. Whenever the goals and ideals of the Islamic Revolution are exposed to threats, women enter the scene of struggles alongside men and prove that the Iranian woman firmly sticks to her covenant with the revolution and the ideals of Imam Khomeini and Ayatollah Khamenei. Women have proved their potentials in various fields beside men. For the past year that coronavirus has spread all over the world, Iranian women have proven their self-sacrifice by rushing to take care and cure patients. Some of them have even delayed their marriage to help the patients. One of the outstanding scenes of selfless efforts was that Fatemeh Mukhbir, daughter of the headquarters for execution of Imam Khomeini's order, volunteered for getting coronavirus jabs. One of the honorable scenes of self-sacrifice and patience was shown by the wife of the prominent nuclear scientist, martyr Dr. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, who said that she would continue the path of her husband, although she had been alongside her husband and seen his assassination. Let us move 1 year back. Last year, the U.S. Terrorist Army, upon the direct order of the former President Donald Trump, targeted the champion of fight against terrorism, Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani, and killed him and the deputy commander of the Iraqi Popular Mobilization Forces, Abu Mahdi al-Mohandes, together with eight of their companions near Baghdad Airport. The Americans thought that the move could stop the movement of the Islamic Revolution and the resistance axis, but martyr Soleimani's daughters Fatima and Zainab stood firmly and announced that they would continue their father's path. Moreover, Zainab took the responsibility of the foundation of Martyr Soleimani's school. Women have undoubtedly played a very important role in the course of the Islamic Revolution. They have shown the culmination of awareness, commitment, steadfastness, and loyalty. These women have participated in cultural, social, political, educational, and economic scenes to help advance the Islamic Revolution. The founder of the Islamic Revolution, Imam Khomeini, explained the role of women in the first month after the victory of the Islamic Revolution. In early March 1979, he said, "You women prove that you are in the forefront. You prove that you are ahead of men. Men are inspired by you. Iran's men have been admonished by women and learned lessons from them." The historic role of men and women in defense of their religion and land is originated in the Islamic culture. Although women have been excluded from armed battle in Islam, they can take part in other aspects of struggle. As a matter of fact, the role of women behind the battlefront cannot be ignored. During the eight-year imposed war, too, women participated in various fields to support the combatants. Many of them worked as doctors and nurses, and hundreds of thousands of them were active in cities in logistics and preparations for the fronts. This took place in the era of Prophet of Islam too. Women like Nasibe and Atiye participated in many of the battles as nurses and assistants. All Muslim ladies have learned these lessons of self-sacrifice from Lady Khadija, Lady Fatima, and Lady Zainab, who spent their life to support Islamic values and ideals. Furthermore, they encouraged their men to go to the war theaters. Imam Khomeini said on these women, "This is the light of faith that you ladies are not scared of martyrdom. Our youths and our men and women are ready for martyrdom. Women are builders of human beings. That's why the domineering system has tried its utmost to deprive them of this role through myriads of stratagems. This system has tried to plunge women in sexuality and corruption through exposure of their beauties to paralyze nations." Contrary to the corrupt wishes of the domineering system led by the U.S., the mothers of martyrs have tried to immortalize their martyrs through keeping the love of God alive among masses. As soon as they heard the news of martyrdom of their sons, they would thank God and appeal to God to accept their sacrifice. Many of these mothers buried their sons themselves. The presence of Muslim ladies in various scenes of the Islamic Revolution has taught the women of other nations and dumbfounded the ill-wishers. A French female reporter wrote in her memoirs of the first year of the revolution, "In Iran, everyone is striving within a great socio-political development to build the structure of an Islamic government. Meanwhile, what is notable more than anything else is the steadfastness and inexhaustibility of women alongside men."
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/EM.
Africa Today.
Africans have for decades been used for unethical clinical trials by large Western pharmaceutical companies in clear violation of their basic human rights. There have been many incidents of unethical experimentation, clinical trials lacking properly informed consent, and forced medical procedures in Africa. The clinical trial of the Pfizer drug Trovan in Nigeria is one of the examples. One of the victims harmed during a 1996 experiment in Nigeria by the U.S. pharmaceutical giant Pfizer elaborates on her suffering. Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today, which is focusing on the long history of crimes committed by Western scientists and pharmaceutical giants in Africa. These crimes have come into focus amid the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic. Since the outbreak, there have been concerns that history will repeat itself and Africans or people of African descent will be used by Western pharmaceuticals to conduct unethical clinical trials for COVID-19 drugs and vaccines. So join us till the end of the show as our experts give you an in-depth analysis on this issue affecting hundreds of millions across Africa.
Pharmaceutical crimes in Africa. Western countries have a long history of illegal and unethical medical testing in Africa. Medical colonialism is a chapter of colonial history in Africa that was not closed and is again in the news amid the COVID-19 virus ravaging many countries in the world. Early April last year, Jean-Paul Mira, head of intensive care at Cochin Hospital in Paris, put forward the idea that tests for coronavirus vaccinations should be carried out in Africa, where he claimed there are no masks and no proper medical care. The research director at France's National Health Institute, INSERM, agreed.
Alors vous avez raison, et d'ailleurs on est en train de réfléchir en parallèle à une étude en Afrique justement pour faire ce même type d'approche avec le BCG, un placebo. Je pense qu'il y a un appel d'offres qui est sorti, il va sortir, et je pense qu'on va en effet sérieusement réfléchir.
This suggestion outraged the director general of the WHO, Tedros Adhanom, himself an African from Ethiopia, who said that Africa will not become a testing ground for COVID-19 vaccines.
It was a disgrace, actually, and appalling to hear during the 21st century from scientists that kind of remark. And we condemn this with the strongest terms possible. But we assure you that this will not happen in Africa.
Clinical trials by Western pharmaceutical giants in Africa are not always conducted according to leading ethical guidelines. This puts clinical trial participants at risk of being physically harmed or having their rights violated. At the same time, excluding the continent from ongoing pandemic research is not the answer. Clinical trials can be ethically done, and many African countries and institutions now have ethics review boards to oversee medical research.
Amid reports that plans were afoot to conduct unethical COVID-19 vaccine trials in the country, by Western research institutions, Kenyan president said that the country will only allow such trials if they follow internationally accepted protocols.
Once we have reached an area where these trials can be tested on humans, fellow Kenyans, as we have been briefing you on a regular basis, we shall keep you informed and we shall let you know, and nothing shall be done in the dark. You will be informed.
Now, for an incisive analysis on the unethical and criminal conduct of Western pharmaceutical companies in Africa, we are joined by Mustafa Traore, an academic, political analyst, and founder of AnOpenEye.org. We also have with us here Dr. Yurga Gelo-Waldeyes, a researcher and lecturer at the Curtin University Center for Human Rights Education in Australia. Thank you, gentlemen, for your time. And we start off with Mr. Gelo. Africa has, for over 100 years, been a testing ground for pharmaceutical companies from the West. They've been conducting unethical clinical trials for drugs. Now, clearly, medical experimentation is entrenched in the history of racism and colonialism. What's your take?
Thank you. I think that is true, because colonialism and racism is not simply the occupation of land and administering people and ruling them. For Africans, or generally for black people in particular, colonialism and racism has a particularly personal impact. They experience it in their body. So colonialism involves the colonization of the black body. The human body itself become a colonial property. Within that framework, colonial experimentations and the gathering of not just experimentation, but generally knowledge from Africans was conducted by treating the people as having no rights, no dignity or agency.
Thanks for that, Dr. Aguilar. Now, can you give us examples on how colonialists used unethical means to conduct medical experiments on Africans?
We can take examples, for example, from Namibia in the early 90s, where sterilization techniques were applied on Herero tribes. We can take examples of controlling African populations using contraceptives such as Depo-Provera in Zimbabwean women, and also in Ghana. We can also take examples where Africans were given the agents that causes trypanosomiasis or sleeping sickness without their consent and knowledge. All of these examples tell us or show us that colonial knowledge or medical knowledge was collected from Africa without the consent, without the participation of the people, and in a way that also deprives the use of those medications or knowledge back to Africans.
Now, let's bring in Mr. Mustafa Traore. What's your opinion on unethical clinical trials by Western pharmaceutical companies on African people?
It seems that for some, in the past, black people, Africans, were the missing link between the monkey and human beings. So we know that scientists have always carried out experiments on animals first before trying the different medicines and on human beings. So this is why it has been the case and for 100 years now, it's still going on. So we've got to be very vigilant with what's happening right now at the moment.
Mr. Traore there says that Africans must be vigilant to stop global pharmaceutical giants from using them as guinea pigs. Back to you, Dr. Gelo. Even after the end of colonialism, Western countries, which claim to be champions of human rights, allow their pharmaceutical companies to conduct unethical trials on Africans. There appears to be no end in sight for these. Will this unfortunate trend continue?
That colonial exploitation was put into new systems. One good example could be the ways in which pharmaceuticals, for example, exercise the right of ownership over inventions that they acquire through experimenting on people.
The earliest reported unethical medical trials on Africans by Westerners were sterilization tests done on Herero women by German doctors. The Herero and Nama genocide was a campaign of racial extermination and collective punishment that the German Empire undertook in German Southwest Africa, now Namibia, against the Herero and the Nama people. It is considered the first genocide of the 20th century. It took place between 1904 and 1908. Despite being one of the richest countries in the world, Germany has yet to compensate the descendants of women who suffered unethical tests in the hands of German scientists during the colonial era. Why are Western countries refusing to take responsibility?
How can you understand that in France, you have people being paid to have babies, the government trying to encourage people to have babies, but at the same time, in some parts of France, because La Réunion is part of France, it's a kind of colony, you had people, or doctors or scientists, sterilizing women against their will. So there's something wrong here. So if we want to compensate, to repair what was done in the past, we've got to stop what we are doing right now.
The clinical trial of the Pfizer drug Troven in Nigeria is cited as one of the outstanding examples of impunity by Western pharmaceutical companies in Africa. In 1996, Kano State in Nigeria suffered a major meningitis outbreak. Top United States pharmaceutical company Pfizer decided to conduct clinical trials to test a drug it was developing. Pharmaceutical crimes in Africa.
The drug had not yet been approved in the United States, where parents were not willing to put up their children as guinea pigs. Pfizer deliberately desisted from obtaining informed consent from the parents of the Nigerian patients. A Nigerian lawyer rejected the company's excuses that the studies were conducted through a deal with the Nigerian government.
At that time, the person, if there was any deal at all, was made by an individual against interest of a government, against interest of a nation. If you get what I'm saying? Now, forget about if any deal was done at all, it was individualistic deal. I don't want to hear about it. Pfizer ought to have known better. Can they do that deal in America? Can they do it in UK or in any of the European countries?
No. Now, because of the adverse effects which the vaccine had on the children, including death and disabilities, the Nigerian federal government filed a suit against Pfizer and several of its employees in June 2007.
The government was seeking nearly $7 billion in damages for the deaths of children involved in the Troven drug trial. In late January 2009, the Nigerian federal government informed the court that it has agreed with Pfizer to settle the lawsuit out of court.
We believe that the case that the federal government has against Pfizer is a good case. There's overwhelming evidence of Pfizer's misconduct. There's overwhelming evidence that Pfizer perpetrated all kinds of fraudulent activities and also engaged in this clinical trial illegally. There are victims who are living today. There are some families of the victims who have died who... What they understood at the time Pfizer came to Nigeria was that Pfizer was volunteering treatment. They did not think that they were volunteering their children as guinea pigs for a clinical examination.
In a move that surprised many, the parties agreed to a settlement figure of only $75 million. WikiLeaks cables suggest that Pfizer may have blackmailed the head of Nigeria's Ministry of Justice into dropping the multi-billion dollar criminal lawsuit. 24 years after the scandal, many victims are yet to be compensated and still can't live normal lives.
Back to you, Dr. Gelo. Do you think Western pharmaceutical corporations are taking advantage of poverty in some African countries by conducting unethical tests on their citizens?
They are not really poor. Poverty is not, lack of food or lack of shelter. That is destitution. Poverty is redefined as lack of what the West has. So how they operate is not because Africans are poor, but because they change the definition of poverty. So that Africans will stop developing their own natural resources, will stop inventing what is relevant for them, will stop using their traditional and natural resources and knowledge to change their future, but instead wait for Western intervention to happen.
Thanks for that insight on destitution and poverty, Dr. Gelo. Now, South African President Cyril Ramaphosa recently raised concerns about the disinformation campaign and conspiracy theories circulating about COVID-19 vaccines.
While the country is in the process of procuring inoculations for its citizens as it fights the pandemic, anti-vaccine sentiments are being expressed by a number of people, including those in higher offices such as political leaders. Clearly, many Africans mistrust vaccines supplied by Western pharmaceutical companies, especially those that have a history of conducting unethical trials on Africans.
Dr. Gelo, is it true that incidents such as the Pfizer scandal in Kano, Nigeria, have led many to doubt even legitimate vaccines and thus negatively impacting on the overall health of the population?
That is a very good example, what happened in Nigeria on the Nigerian children who had meningitis by this big corporation, raises the alarm that, you know, Africans are genuinely justified to doubt and are justified to ask strong guarantees, strong commitment that they will be beneficiaries. These experiences show us that there is no genuine desire to solve the problem of life, to solve the problem of Africans. The greatest drive is actually to acquire profit, to make more money. So there is a primacy of profit over the value of life. Within this context, then Africans are really justified to doubt.
Last year, there were protests in South Africa when the University of Witwatersrand, in partnership with the Oxford University, rolled out South Africa's first clinical trial. Protesters say they did not want Africans to be used as guinea pigs, reflecting concerns among many in Africa over testing drugs on people who do not understand the risks.
I'm not happy at all. I mean, this feels like 1981 all over again, or in the 1980s all over again, when the AIDS pandemic just broke out in SA. It feels like the same thing. It's like a replay, but this time they're doing it in our face.
Mr. Traore, you earlier talked about vigilance in the face of unethical practices by Western pharmaceutical companies. Now, can you elaborate, especially in the context of the COVID-19 vaccine?
Keep on repeating it. Every bad thing that we do to African countries, okay, if it is accepted and if no one says anything, we are later going to do the same thing to our own population. So this is why we've got to be very vigilant, especially right now with the vaccines against COVID-19. Okay? So this is, we don't know what they have in their vaccines. We do not know. So I think, you know, when you have people in the world talking about reducing the population on Earth, you've got to be very vigilant.
In a very selfish move in June last year, the U.S. government bought up virtually all the stocks for 3 months of remdesivir, which has proven to work against COVID-19. This immoral and unethical decision by the U.S. left none for the rest of the world, including Africans who are involved in its clinical trials. Now, Dr. Gelo, we saw how the U.S. prevented African countries from obtaining remdesivir in the fight against COVID-19, yet Africans were used in its clinical trials. What's your view on this?
A lot of Africans from Liberia, from Guinea, from Democratic Republic of Congo were participating in experimental treatment for Ebola. So this medicine was administered to them, and it is by that participation, through that process, that this medicine became accepted as harmless for humans and can be used now for COVID-19. But what we see after all of this happened is the company that has sole ownership over this invention, the company called Gilead, has now is kind of exercising the right to give patent to selected companies and countries, and it is really unlikely that Africans will have easy access to this medication.
Mr. Traore, some Africans are skeptical about COVID-19 vaccines being sourced from Western countries. Is there a reason to doubt these vaccines?
I think this is the West, and everyone loves Africa, but they do not love the Africans. So Africans have to be very careful with that. They have to be aware of that. So this is why this is a crime. We know that when you've got some Americans talking about the fact that there are too many of us on Earth, that we should limit or reduce the population on Earth. We know that the first target is the African continent. This is where you have all the resources.
Mr. Traore there believes that some of these COVID-19 vaccines are actually a ploy to wipe out Africans. What do you think? Let us know through our social media handle. Now, Mr. Gelo, you get to have the last word in our show today. Tell us, what should African countries do to prevent Western pharmaceutical giants from using the continent as a testing ground for their drugs?
People have become, disposables if they are not useful for the system. That autonomy which we envision through various kinds of mechanisms such as human rights and others are not really being observed because governments are not observing the dignity of human beings. They are interested rather in protecting the profits, property rights, patent rights of corporations and companies. And governments which are meant to serve their own population, especially the poor, are not carrying out their duties in the way they are expected according to these international agreements of human rights that they signed up to. So I think we need to come back to the human, to our own human sense of dignity, a dignity that we give to life, and respect that life is more important than profit.
Well, life is more important than profit. We hope governments and global multinationals will listen to that advice and stop exploiting people for profits. And with that, viewers, we come to the end of this week's edition of Africa Today. Do let us know your opinion about our show. Your comments are of immense value to us. On behalf of the entire Africa Today team, I would like to thank you all. And until next time, goodbye and take care.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iran Sat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.